From the Annals of Thoracic Surgery and the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, welcome to Beyond the Abstract, part of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons Surgical Hot Topic Series. I'm Tom Varghese, a thoracic surgeon and deputy editor of digital media and digital scholarship for the Annals. This is a podcast all about the why behind articles and issues in cardiothoracic surgery and healthcare, and what are the planned next steps from authors and thought leaders in the field. We're glad that you are here. If you enjoy our program, please rate our podcast on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you downloaded this podcast. Your feedback is appreciated. On today's episode, we speak with Dr. Leah Backus, Associate Professor, Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery at Stanford University, who also splits time at the Palo Alto VA, where she practices general thoracic surgery, and also Dr. David Cook, Head of General Thoracic Surgery at UC Davis in Sacramento, Program Director of the Cardiothoracic Surgery Residency there, and Vice Chair for Faculty Development for the Department of Surgery. We're going to be discussing their article, Culture of Safety and Gender Inclusion in Cardiothoracic Surgery, which was published in the October 2018 issue of the Annals of Thoracic Surgery. Please remember, the opinions expressed in this podcast are that of the individuals and not necessarily of STS. So Dr. Backus, let's start with why. Why do you think this article or work is critically needed at this time for our specialty?
I think the topic of diversity and inclusion in general is an important topic, and you can pretty much apply it to almost any walk of life or profession that you choose to do so, and you'll find ample things to be explored in that same theme. Specific to this particular article, though, this was a little bit of a roundabout way, I think, of introducing the topic to partner patient safety with a discussion about gender equity within the context of cardiothoracic surgery. I think it was a bit of a novel approach. And when initially approached to write this article, I have to say, even for myself, it was a little bit difficult to kind of wrap my brains around what seemed like two relatively disparate topics. But once we got the writing team together, the number of topics and themes to explore really kind of exploded, and it became pretty difficult to actually kind of whittle things down into the article that was eventually published. But so I think it is really timely. As I mentioned, when we talk about sort of the broader context of gender diversity, you just have to look at the numbers. If you look at the numbers in terms of gender representation, cardiothoracic surgery, it's pretty abysmal. You know, we're at 6% for women board certified in CT surgery, and that is second only to orthopedic surgery with regards to all medical specialties. It's pretty bad. It's better than it has been historically, but still, I think by almost anyone's standards, that would be a very low number of representation. So I think that the issue, the number, is just kind of a glaring testament to the problem. But when you talk about sort of the timeliness, it really is a nice extension of the things that are already going on in the world around us. You look at the hashtag I Look Like a Surgeon, the hashtag MeToo movement. All these things are really kind of, I think, indicative of a growing sentiment among women in general that we need to be heard and that we really want to achieve equality in all walks of life. I think particularly for cardiothoracic surgery, as I mentioned, that the problem is definitely more acute than in other areas of medicine, and it's actually finally now being recognized to the extent that it should, starting to be. I'll emphasize the starting to be. But within, you know, the STS, and Dr. Cook can attest to that too as the chair of our task force on diversity and inclusion. So I think it's incredibly timely to shed a light on this. And to tie it into patient safety, to kind of underscore the whole thing, it's not diversity for diversity's sake. It's diversity for the purposes of being excellent overall, for being academically oriented, for being conscious of patient safety, and for trying to produce the next generation of leaders in our field.
I think you've raised some very great points. But extending on that, you've touched on a lot of general issues, and of course, CT surgery looks abysmal in terms of the total stats. But are there other issues in gender diversity that are specific to our field, or are we just a reflection of general themes that cut across all types of specialties?
I think it's probably more of the latter, honestly. I mean, we like to think that we're a very special bunch, and we are special in some ways, and I think that there are some nuanced differences in CT surgery, but for the most part, I think we mirror what's been happening everywhere else. The biggest thing that emphasizes the fact that we are slow to change. I think that's the thing that separates us predominantly, is the fact that we have been traditionally slow as a specialty to adapt to change. Even if you look at just sort of endovascular techniques, anything that's new and cutting edge, it kind of seems like it takes CT surgeons a while, if you will, to sort of recognize an issue and to jump on it give it the appropriate amount of attention that it deserves. We also do really high stakes operations, and I think that in and of itself has traditionally drawn upon or drawn towards it a particular demographic of people who may have kind of been more macho, for lack of a better word, maybe seen as kind of the cowboys of surgery. We certainly need to get some cowgirls in there, but, seen as the cowboys of surgery. And so I think that kind of just, that's been the culture, that's been the predominant, theme, if you will, and that really has been a barrier for implementing the changes that need to occur. I also think something specific for CT surgery is the fact that we have a long training paradigm and long careers. And so in order to see any kind of changes in terms of the overall demographics, we have to see a big change in the turnover of physicians, and the fact that cardiothoracic surgery surgeons operate till their dying breath, means that we don't have the type of turnover required to see any kind of rapid change. You can still see it, but I just feel like it's going to take us a while to get there.
That's a sobering thought that all of us have many, many decades ahead of us still left to work. That's great. Dr. Cook, question for you and this is really in the article. I thought that, I'm biased. I love that layout on table one. The entire writing committee just really called out, here are some specific interventions to decrease gender disparities in surgery. The question for you is, in your role as a leader at your university and who has successfully recruited women surgeons over the years, that one of the metrics was interventions was mentioned as transparent, objective compensation plans. Has that been something that's been easy to do in your practice, and is that the reason why you've been able to successfully recruit women to UC Davis? Or are there still existing barriers to really, truly achieve transparency in that metric?
So Tom, that's a very good question. Gender pay inequity is a problem not only in surgery, whether it's academic medicine or community-based practice, but probably throughout the majority of sort of quote-unquote white-collar type of occupations. It could be a challenge in regards to having transparency in compensation. I think in our environment and a public university, whether it's University of California, whether it's UC Davis, UCSF, or et cetera, or say University of Michigan, it's a little bit easier because our salaries are publicly reported. So individual can go online and look at the salaries of every single employee of the University of California above a certain pay threshold, whether it's myself or whether it's the Cal Berkeley football coach. You can look up salaries. So that makes it a little bit easier for faculty members. I think also having a defined salary structure, and that includes a starting off point. When you look at academic medicine, you could look at the AAMC faculty salary survey, And what they do is they take a survey of different faculty salaries for assistant, associate, and full professors. They divide that into four regions, Northeastern, Southern, Midwestern, and Western. And they provide a 25 percentile median and 75 percentile and mean for salaries within that framework. And that can serve as a starting off point in regards to what a person's salary should be. And then also looking at different cost of living calculators. So taking all that in consideration, those are sort of steps in sort of having a defined salary structure to try to eliminate gender-based pay inequities.
I was just going to add two more things. I think you know, Dr. Cook just completely elucidated all of that from the standpoint of the institution and things that the institution needs to do to try to help address the problem. From the individual perspective, one of the things that I think I found most striking is the fact that at the time of hire, your salary differential, which is going to exist from day one, is going to be perpetuated all the way up. Like, even if you ascend the ladder at the same rate as your next male counterpart to you, for instance, if you all come in with disparate salaries, which is often the case, that pay gap will persist. So, you know, we've really got to educate women how it is that we can better negotiate and advocate for ourselves so that we can come in even at the same starting point. And then the other thing that I was going to say is that when it comes to wage gaps by specialty, you know, a very interesting article that I saw recently, I feel like it was in JAMA perhaps, but it showed basically that the wage gap inversely follows the gender gap in terms of representation. So the least diverse that your specialty is, the more disparate your salary gap is, or the larger the salary gap is between genders, which I found sobering.
You know, and extending from what you had said before, that we as a specialty already have a massive problem in this particular area, one could only imagine what the wage gap is going to be. I was going to flip the question to you about, since David had mentioned that one of the luxuries they have is, as a public university, all their salaries are publicly reported. What about in the private university setting? I mean, there at Stanford, for example, is that more difficult to do because they don't have the rules that they can lay on that all the public universities have to do? Or did you have any thoughts on that?
I do have a thought, which is that I'd love to not get in trouble with my boss.
No, we all agreed at the beginning that we were going to push boundaries. So, no, you can't hide under that.
Okay. My next thought, however, is that it's not very transparent at all. That's not just Stanford, and that's not just our department. But that the transparency exists only when it is mandated to be there, for the most part. I think there are very few kind of just innately transparent leaders, unlike David, you know, who values the transparency and the ease with which they're able to otherwise negotiate with people, et cetera. I think that, and this is, of course, speaking from the standpoint of someone who's not a leader, who's not influential in terms of determining folks or negotiating folks' salaries, that that perhaps there's a bias among leaders that having that transparency somehow handicaps them in their ability to, as opposed to it being an advantage, if you will, when negotiating and having salary discussions with your faculty members. But I guess it's sort of a question for David. I don't think that the transparency is there at all.
David, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it can be difficult in a private setting, and a little bit complex and nuanced, but I think empowering the new faculty or the person looking at that position to look at themselves as an asset, right, and understanding their worth. One thing I also caution, especially new grads, you know, especially on the cardiac side of things, we oftentimes feel that we need to do some sort of apprenticeship for the first 6 months or et cetera before really becoming independent. And, you know, that's all set and good, and there needs to be technical and clinical mentorship. but you don't want to be in a situation where you're fundamentally an assistant surgeon. And that goes back to what Dr. Bacchus was saying earlier, where your initial salary is can be, if not identified, perpetuated indefinitely as a disparity. You really want to be a independent surgeon as quickly as possible, so you're not billing as an assistant surgeon.
That makes sense as well. Dr. Bacchus, the question back to you. In the article, there's mentioned that, in quotes, studies suggest that equity, which is the quality of being fair and impartial, is not the main issue, but rather equality, which is the relationship between two entities being valued similarly. Can you expand on that? I mean, I think that's an interesting concept because in the world of surgery, isn't it the reality that actually you have both? In other words, what would you think is more at play? Is it an equity issue or an equality issue, or does it not really matter?
That's a tough one to expand upon. I think, because I think you can have, for instance, equity and numbers. You know, you can have sort of an equitable, which we don't have, right? But let's say you did.
Which we don't have, right.
Right. Let's say you did have an equitable distribution of numbers that kind of mirrors that of the demographics of our population, et cetera. And you can extend that beyond gender, of course, to any other minority group. But that doesn't mean that you have equality. That doesn't mean that you have hardwired processes in place that are going to make sure that your equity is maintained and perpetuated up the ladder, that you have appropriate distribution of resources, that you value the same amount of work that's being done by those individuals. And that's something that I think you started to ask David about was kind of, or that was in the table at least, you know, when we talk about placing value on the academic work of people who are doing things that are traditionally thought to be less valuable. You have a disproportionate, disproportionate is probably not the best word, but you have a larger percentage of female faculty who tend towards more educational-based activities and whatnot. And if in your department you don't see those as valuable, then they're not going to be rewarded and you're not going to be promoted based upon them. So, I would parse the two by saying that one is a matter of numbers and the other is a matter of value.
Okay. But the reality is our specialty, even though you may say one may be have a little bigger role, the reality is both issues are still at place for our specialty just because even our numbers are drastically too low, correct?
Our numbers are low, and I think that's a challenge because that requires us, if we're not recruiting from a diverse pool, so we're not recruiting women, then we're limiting ourselves to sort of 50% of a potential applicant pool, and that will result ultimately into a brain drain in our specialty and ultimately a lack of innovation and opportunity for new ideas within our specialty. And that's really gets to the heart of the paper, I think, in regards to that lack of innovation, lack of perspective, and different point of view from the clinician can potentially hurt our patients. One example is the lack of women in clinical trials, and specifically cardiovascular clinical trials, and lung cancer clinical trials, even though cardiovascular disease and lung cancer are the top killers of women. And a lot of that may be because many of these clinical trials aren't designed by women, and many of the principal investigators or site investigators for these trials aren't women, and therefore don't design ways to recruit women or look from a woman's perspective and why they would not enroll in a clinical trial. So I think our numbers of women and diverse individuals in our specialty are low, but unless we want to not innovate and not expand our specialty for the betterment of our patients, we need to look at ways to recruit more women into our specialty.
I think that's well said. I guess both of you are saying that we have to be very intentional about this, that there has to be an intent to recruit, as you were saying, from a diverse pool, but we have to change the way of thinking of what's been historically done. Because Leah mentioned this, that you know everything in CT surgery sadly evolves at a very slow pace. So I guess the question to both of you is, you know, how do we go about doing that? I mean, do we need a shock to the culture? I mean, is Me Too and all these movements out there, are they enough? Or how do we go about being intentional about increasing the recruitment?
I'll start off by saying, yeah, we've been very unintentional up to this point, and it's not working, right? Like, I mean, we've already tried that, and we can sort of chalk this up to a relative failure in terms of anything that we've done heretofore to actually really move the needle. So I would completely agree that we've got to be extremely deliberate about it. It is very difficult to be deliberate and be the impetus of change when you're on the ground level. And the main issue we have is we don't have ample representation in the higher ranks. In the leadership positions that are the ones that tend to be most influential at catalyzing change. So what option do we have? We have to make sure that the leaders that are there get it. So I think the ground level folks have to kind of amplify the message to the leadership to prove the point, to make the case for diversity, and that's been done ad nauseum in many different fields. And move away from diversity for diversity's sake, but diversity for the sake of all these important things that collectively we value together, right? We all value patient safety. We all value patient outcomes. We all value education. You know, these are all common areas of common ground that we can all agree upon are important things for our specialty. And once we kind of recognize the fact that diversity is intrinsic to any and all of those agendas, only then will we get all of the folks in the leadership positions to be on board to actually help put processes in place that will translate into change. But the biggest thing is, you know, knowing what the landscape looks like in terms of that, and I'm speaking of leadership in very generic terms here, but the landscape of leadership in CT surgery is overwhelmingly male. We know that. That's fine. But what we've got to do is make sure that we've got champions within there. You don't have to be female to advocate for equity and quality and value, right? And I think that those are some of the messages that we need to get. But we can't really necessarily expect those in the leadership positions to kind of who aren't necessarily seeing this every day and having it affect their daily lives, place a priority on it. The way that it becomes prioritized is from those folks who are experiencing it every day, chronicling those experiences and amplifying the message.
David, did you want to comment on that?
I'll do a brief comment. Yeah, I think what Dr. Baca said was excellent and on point. You know, I think the STS recently did a survey of its memberships asking questions of about diversity and inclusion, and the majority of respondents said that having a diverse workforce is important. So I think when we talk about diversity and inclusion, and especially gender diversity, it's not really a diversity for diversity's sake. I think when you look at leadership, and you need, in order to have a diverse workforce, you really need a diverse group of people who make decisions upon that workforce. So that includes department chairs, division chiefs, service line leaders, and program directors. And really diversifying that group of individuals really forces the decision process to take in mind a diverse pool of potential members of the workforce. Now, that doesn't mean we're not talking about quotas. We're not talking about
you read my mind, David. That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, go ahead and expand on admission and quotas.
We're not talking about quotas. We're not talking about, you know, recruiting people who don't have the chops to be there or the curriculum vitae to be there. It just means opening up your mind and your perspective to look for value in those individuals who don't look like you and are not from your own background.
Absolutely. David, you know, Leah had really laid out a great case of, you know, we need to do a better job of educating or informing at the leader level, you know, the people who are making the critical decisions. But for you, as a vice chair in the Department of Surgery, are you seeing more informed faculty these days at the beginning of their job tenure? You know, and that's on, like, knowledge content of promotion criteria, leave policies, tenure clock extensions, salary structure. Are you seeing that, or is that still a problem, that we still need to increase the knowledge content of the people at the beginning of their career?
No, I'm not seeing it. Now, that being said, I'm probably seeing a little bit. I think people have when they're recruited, they have overarching general understanding of the concepts for promotion and advancement, and the credit goes to, you know, our alphabet societies, you know, like the STS and the AATS for having different workshops to help residents understand some of these basic concepts. But in regards to really, you know, part of my role is to sit down and walk new faculty through the process of what they need to do, what milestones they need to achieve to advance within their series, their academic series, and to be promoted. And why is that important? And I look at different institutions, and many institutions have a problem with diversity, whether it's ethnic diversity or gender diversity. They have a problem. Yet, what I see is a lot of these institutions put best faith efforts into fighting that problem. It's not like they don't care, but they really fight for that problem. And in studying it, a lot of the issues is not necessarily a creating a culture where someone who's from a diverse background feels comfortable. It's creating a culture to allow any junior faculty member to achieve the criteria of their series and then be promoted. So if it's difficult for every junior faculty across the board to be successful in their series and be promoted, but you're already behind the eight ball where you have very few women junior faculty or very few minority junior faculty, if that particular woman is unable to be promoted or fails advancement in her series, is it because of a difficult environment for being a woman, or is it because the academic environment for any junior faculty is difficult, and therefore your one woman junior faculty doesn't get promoted, and similar to the three other non-diverse junior faculty who also aren't promoted, but that woman stands out, or that underrepresented minority faculty member stands out. So what we've tried to do here at UC Davis is really stack the cards in the favor of our junior faculty. So they understand the requirements for merit advancement and promotion. We've developed what are called launch committees, where the first year faculty meet with different leaders, not only within the department but outside the department, to try to steer them in the right direction. Events where they have sort of a happy hour with our department chair and other faculty leaders to ask specific questions, and having someone like me going through their candidate statement for merit advancement promotion and promotion to make sure that they are bragging about themselves in a very good manner. So those are all challenges for new faculty within an academic setting.
I think that's a great point. the good Lord knows that the three of us have had lengthy conversations on this topic over the years. But in the closing moments that we have to each of you, and I'll ask Dr. Backus first, you know, in terms of the critical steps that we need to go forward, I think you can probably put them under two broad categories. There's raising awareness of the issue and then the steps needed to change the paradigm. What are your thoughts, Leah, in terms of what we need to do? What are the next steps in terms of those two areas? How do we raise awareness and how do we change the paradigm?
Well, I mean, I think some of these steps are being taken currently. And for those of us that are fortunate enough to be a part of that, we should be given credit for doing that. It's articles like this one that was just published. It's another article that's in the work that David and I just partnered on. There's another series of articles that are coming out from the task force that he chairs. So those are a few things. They're working within our organizations to try to help and as I said, amplify the message to the masses within our specialty, because they have the platforms with which we can do that. Social media helps things like this. It's not just the publication, it's the amplification after the publication that also helps to disseminate the message. I think one of the things that I wanted to highlight is the fact that we need to kind of help the leaders, as opposed to sort of viewing the problem as one where the leaders themselves are part of the problem. We should really give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, as I said, if you're not someone who's otherwise not necessarily experiencing the effects of unconscious bias or overt bias on a daily basis, this may not be really on your radar very much. And yes, of course, we're going to try to do the things we can to get that message there. But even once you have a person who's in an influential position that actually gets it, quote unquote, how is it that they're going to be able to affect the change? And I think that they're going to need some help. They need help from the institution in terms of institutional commitment, but they also need training. You know, one of the things that David mentioned was kind of the onboarding process for academic faculty and what that should look like at a given, it's not going to be the same. It's not a one-size-fits-all from one institution to the next, nor is it from one department or even in one individual to the next. So certainly there are blueprints to convey to that person that are institution specific, but there's also, I think, something that has to occur where we destigmatize discussions on things that are slapping us in the face all the time. Like, there is gender inequity. There is racial bias. These are things that are there. They're the elephants in the room, and I think that many leaders feel ill-equipped to deal with them. But in ignoring them, they're perpetuating the problem just as bad as if they simply ignored that candidate to begin with. So hiring someone on without recognizing, hey, this junior faculty member may actually face a whole different set of circumstances that can truly influence their ability to ascend the ladder, as I'd hope them to do, given all the investment that was made in bringing them on board, or have just an awful stain on the department because we have this huge amount of attrition. How is it that leader should feel safe to engage in a discussion with that new hire about these sensitive subjects without otherwise feeling any fear of reprisal, you know, that they're venturing into illegal territory or something like that? I don't have an answer as to how to do that, but I know that there are ample, what's the word I'm looking for? Not opportunities, but resources available that institutions are privy to. And I think that we need to really kind of emphasize how is it that we can equip those leaders to be comfortable working in this space.
Dr. Cook, same question to you on the two fronts in terms of steps ahead, in terms of raising awareness and changing the paradigm. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think really having the articles like this front and center, and I really wanted to congratulate the journals, our cardiothoracic journals, for looking for these articles and publishing them, because I know that the readership is vast. The other thing is, there really needs to be a look at the leadership level. And I think there have been strides in regards to diversification of leadership roles. I think if you look at department chairs throughout the country, there are more and more women who are department chairs. And I think those individuals have the opportunities to elevate folks into leadership positions within there. I think if you are a division chief throughout the country, maybe you look at your roster of individuals and have a associate division chief who's a person of color or a woman who brings a different perspective in terms of how you do things. If you're a program director, you have an associate program director who comes with a different toolkit and a different perspective. And that allows you to understand if there are microaggressions within your division or your selection process. Is your interview process for your residents and trainees, is it fair and equitable? Are you looking at the right candidates when you're looking to hire for a position or hire for a trainee or a resident? And are you not looking at candidates for all the wrong reasons? And some of that reasons may be just benign neglect of a potential stellar candidate. So I think our specialty is starting to do that. And if you look at the STS with creation of this task force for diversity and inclusion, but also in other leadership positions, that really the charge of those leadership positions have nothing to do with diversity and inclusion, but the workforces and the committees are becoming more diverse. And that brings a different point of view and a different perspective that can only make our specialty better, more innovative, and restore the health of our patients more efficiently.
That's well said. You know, in closing, I just wanted to read out the final sentence from this phenomenal article, and to the listeners out there, I really encourage you to not just read this once, but really deep dive into it a couple times. The last sentence says, healthcare organizations can positively impact their culture and patient outcomes by acknowledging the presence of bias and gender gap and prioritizing diversity efforts. And what I'd like to do is to thank both of you for being those positive change agents. You know, this is a critical issue for our specialty. It's a critical issue across the world of medicine, but we all need to do this together. And I wanted to thank you both for taking the time to participate in the podcast tonight, as well as looking forward to the work ahead. Thank you both.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, thank you.
Join us next time as we continue to explore and debate issues beyond the abstract, part of the Surgical Hot Topics series. You can connect with the Annals of Thoracic Surgery online at annalsthoracicsurgery.org or on Twitter at annalsthorsurge.